It's the Green Man Tavern, where my affairs will be conducted. Bear boldly pushed through the doorway. Though I followed on his heels, I was more than a little hesitant, knowing his business, as he had said himself, was dangerous. Chapter 35. We entered into a large room in which a few small tallow candles had been stuck into crannies in the walls. Despite the sputtering light, it was a dim and smoky place that reeked of bad ale, stale bread, and sour wine. Trestle tables and benches, more than I had ever seen in one place, stood beneath a low-beamed ceiling. The floor was made of thick wood slabs strewn with dirty rushes. To one side stood a kind of counter, upon which sat rows of wooden tankards. Behind this counter stood a large, buxom woman. Dressed in a brown, grease-spotted kirtle, she had a lopsided white linen cap upon her dark and grey-streaked tresses. Around her waist was a belt of glassy rosary beads, from which dangled a leather purse. Wooden pattens were on her feet. As for her face, it was a flushed and rosy red. Her nose was flat, as if it had once been broken. Her cheeks were sunken too. Withal, she cast off a brimming, bustling force. When we came forward, she squinted to see who was there. As Bear loomed large before her, a grand grin spread upon her face, revealing not just joy, but a complete lack of teeth. "Gotch woonsh!" she cried with lisping, spittle-sprayed laughter. "It's the Bear set loose among us again!"
"And on my honour," Bear said, his voice booming, his arms spread wide, "it's the Widow Daventry!"
The two embraced in the middle of the room.
"Welcome back to Great Wexley," the woman said, pushing Bear away, even as she looked him up and down. "I was wondering if you'd come, but you've been true."
"Fair lady," Bear laughed, making a mock bow, "I always keep my word."
"But once again, sir, I fear you've not come to court me," she said.
"Alas, it's my other business," said he.
Then, to my astonishment, the woman smote him hard in the chest with a tight fist, a blow which only made him laugh even more. Not content with that assault, she pulled his beard and tweaked his cheek.
"And what escapades have befallen you since you were here last?" she asked, laughing with such delight I couldn't keep from grinning too.
"Many an adventure, you can be sure," he said. "And there stands one of them." Bear pointed at me.
The woman turned and considered me with squinty eyes.
"Is he yours, or did you find him in some swamp?"
Before he answered, Bear looked around. What he might have been searching for, I don't know, for only the three of us were there.
"It was God's sweet grace that let him find me."
"How did that happen?"
"We met in an abandoned village. He'd fled his village."
"Did he?" the woman said, and looked at me with new interest. "For what reason?"
"In search of a grander world," said Bear.
"And what of his father? His mother?"
"Both gone to a better world."
"An orphan, then, and not pursued?" she asked, clearly relishing the tale.
"That's another matter," Bear said with a frown. "But by the laws of this realm," he said, "he's fully bound to me now. My apprentice, and a likely lad."
It felt good to hear his praise.
"What's your name?" she asked me.
I made myself look up.
"It's Crispin." "Now there's a high-born name for a lowly lad," the woman said. "But Crispin, pay no heed to my bantering. Bear's friends are mine. Welcome to the Green Man's Inn. Where do you come from?
When I hesitated, Bear said,
Crispin, name your village.
Stromford,
I said.
Never heard of it,
the woman said with a shrug.
One of Lord Furnival's holdings, Bear said.
Lord Furnival,
the woman said, turning from me back to Bear.
Have you not heard the news?
That Lord Furnival died,
he said.
Aye, 2 weeks ago,
the woman said. As Bear made the sign of the cross over his heart, I said, How did you know? Not sure which surprised me more, that he had known or that he hadn't told me.
The black cloth draped around town, he replied, and the extra soldiers at the gates.
To be sure, the woman said, when great men die, there's always unrest. He died in his bed, she added, from the wounds he earned at the French wars. I suppose it will only encourage your enterprise, she said with some unease.
Widow, he said, it's not my enterprise.
As I watched and listened to the two of them, it was clear she had more knowledge of Bear and his business than I. It gave me a jealous pang.
Who will succeed the Lord? Bear said.
He has no legal heirs, the woman said, though it's been rumoured there are some illegitimate ones.
And all his property?
It now belongs to his widow, the Lady Furnival. Unless some bastard son, with an army at his back, makes a claim. Or until she marries, if she marries. But they say that's unlikely. She's not the type to relinquish her new powers. She never travelled with Lord Furnival, but preferred to stay in her court. You know what women say, she added with a grin. If the first marriage is a gift from God, the second comes straight from hell.
That said, there was an awkward moment of silence. Bear was tense. I did not know exactly what had occurred, but it made me recall something Father Quinnell had told me once at confession. A moment of silence in the midst of talk means death's angel is close at hand. I shuddered. Chapter 36.
But you, she said to Bear, must sit and slake your thirst. I want to know all you've learned since you've last been here.
Bear relaxed.
If you'll be so good as to fetch me the key to my room in the solar, the special one, he added, I'll settle the boy, then we can speak.
Though realizing I was being put aside, I said nothing but simply followed Bear. Key in one hand, he led me up the steps to the second story. I'd never climbed so high in a building before, so high that I furtively put a hand to the wall to steady myself. We went along a dark, narrow hallway until we reached a door, which he unlocked.
"Our solar," he informed me. "Go on."
I stepped inside. By the little light that seeped through a shuttered window, I observed a small room. Old rushes lay on the floor. A small low table stood in one corner. In another corner was a large pallet of hay. The place had a rank, close smell of sweat and ale that made me feel slightly ill, used as I was to open air. Bear fluffed up the pallet.
Bear?
What?
This building. It's so high. Might it fall down?
He looked at me for a disbelieving moment, then erupted with one of his big laughs.
There is no chance. None.
There was a knock on the door. Widow Daventry entered. In her hands was a bowl with meat in thick sauce. Pieces of bread were mixed in. To my surprise, she offered it to me. I took it gratefully.
Yours is below,
she said to Bear, and left. I sat on the hay, cross-legged, bowl in my lap, horn spoon in hand.
As Bear removed his dagger and laid it on the table, I said, "Will we perform here?" I asked.
"I think not," he said to my further surprise. "Our time here will be very short. But I must show you something."
He went to the wall and felt about the wooden boards.
"This is a special room," he said. "My friend below always gives it to me."
Under the pressure of his hands, a slab of wood popped out from the wall.
"It's a hiding place. It will hold you and me too, for that matter, if there's need."
"Will there be a need?"
"By all of heaven's sacred saints, I pray not."
"Bear," I said, looking directly at him, "what is it you really do?"
He laughed. "When we met," he said, "you dared not even ask my name. Now you stare brazenly at me and presume to ask of my affairs. Have we risen in the world or fallen?"
"That's for you to say," I said.
"As to what I really do," he said with a placating smile, "I'm a fool, because I should like to be in heaven before I die."
He reached for the door. "I don't want to stay here," I said. "It's close and ill-smelling."
"You'll do as you're told."
"Yes, master," I said, knowing my saying so would irritate him.
"Then, at least, don't lock the door." "I won't," he said, then paused.
For a moment, I thought he would speak more. But all he said was,
"Crispin, on your life, remain here until I return."
With that, he left. Feeling much aggrieved, I ate the food, then lay back upon the straw. I was not very happy. Why, I asked myself, should I remain in such a stuffy place while he did as he pleased? Besides, my glimpses of the town had only whetted my curiosity. And I had a penny of my own. There was much still to see, but it sounded as if Bear intended to keep me in the room for what now appeared to be a short stay. For a while I remained where I was, though as time passed I fretted more and more. Finally I got up, went to the door, and peeked into the hall. Seeing no one about, I made up my mind to wander the town for a short time. My intent was that I would return before Bear even noticed I had left. I was just about to leave when I went to the table and plucked up Bear's sheathed dagger and hid it underneath my tunic. Had he not taught me to use it? Was not this town in which to claim my liberties? Moving quietly, I crept halfway down the stairs and listened. From somewhere I could hear the murmurs of Bear's talk, as well as Widow Daventry's. Exactly where they were I didn't know. I continued down until I was certain no one was in the tavern room. At the base of the steps, I decided it would be better if I didn't use the front door, lest they see me. Instead, I made a sharp turn and went along a narrow hall. At the end of it, I reached a small door. Pushing it open, I stepped into an alley that had the most appalling stench. It was the place where privies were set over open ditches. Holding my nose, I shut the door behind me and raced away. Chapter 37. It was mid-afternoon, shortly after the bells had rung for noon, when I stepped away from the back door of the Green Man. Running, I regained the main street, and once there began to look upon the town at my ease. As I went about, the hurly-burly world of countless people, buildings and wares struck me with even greater force. If anything, Great Wexley seemed more tumultuous, with more people, more happenings than even before. But I was feeling bold and quite sure of myself. I don't need Bear to see the world, thought I.
as I stood upon the street, enjoying the buffeting of those who passed, not sure which way I wished to go. A crowd of children rushed by, yowling and laughing. Curious to know where they would go and what they would do, I ran after them. The young people turned this way and that, and then, just as they had appeared, they vanished. I'd not the slightest idea where they had gone. Though baffled, I was not a bit disconcerted. With so much to see, I was content to ramble on, pausing to look at whatever took my interest, of which there was no scarcity. As for my penny, I purchased some white bread from a street vendor. It was light and sweet, and took little chewing to get down, which I found passing strange. After a while, I found the courage to leave the main, stone-paved street, and began to wander among backways. These proved to be dirt and mud lanes. Though very narrow, they cast an even greater stench than the main thoroughfare. These ways twisted and turned in every conceivable direction, with no logic that I could grasp. Yet I found myself excited not to know where I was going. How marvellously odd, I thought, to be required to pick and choose which way to go. What did I care that I had to make so many choices? It gave my head a pleasing whirl. And still more people, of so many kinds. Some, I could see, from the way they dressed, were poor. Yet even so, they appeared to mingle with others of far greater wealth, and no one took offence. In time I found myself upon the main stone street again. It was there I saw a woman riding side-saddle astride a great black palfrey whose saddle and harness were trimmed with gleaming silver. Though the lady wore a black cape, I could see her gown. It was a brilliant blue, trimmed with golden fur. Her hair was tucked behind a squared-off, ruffled, netted cap of black lace. Her feet were shod in golden shoes with pointy tips. Her small hands were encrusted with sparkling jewels. As for her face, of elder years, it was pale and haughty, and did not, or so it seemed, take in the world about her. Yet as she went by, she pressed a silken cloth to her nose, as if to block the offending street stench. Her nose knew where she was. Before her marched a boy dressed entirely in black, a short golden-blue cape draped over one shoulder. He carried a long horn of bright metal from which dangled a flag of blue and gold. With every few steps he took, he lifted the horn to his lips and blared out notes to announce the lady's progress. Clustered around this lady were six men, wearing tunics with padded chests, their puffed sleeves lengthened to cover half their hands. One man led the lady's horse, others marched on either side of her, while three more came behind. By the swords they carried, it was clear they were her guards. Though not so sumptuously dressed as she, they were splendid enough to look upon in their blue and gold livery. On each left sleeve was a band of black. For me she was an amazing sight. I had never seen such astounding wealth, another marvel for my eyes. As she passed, people on the streets hastily made way for her, some doffing their hats or inclining their heads in reverence. Some even went down upon their knees, so I knew her to be a personage of great power. And yet, when the noble lady had once gone by, the crowds knitted together just as before, milling about, strolling, buying or selling. It was as if she had never been there. "Who is that?" I asked a boy standing near. He gave me a look of astonishment, as if I should have known. "Why, it's Lady Furnival!" I turned quickly to look after her, but she had gone. Chapter 38. All afternoon I wandered in a kind of daze, beguiled by what I saw. It was as if my world had multiplied many times in size, numbers, and wealth. My eyes fairly ached with marvels seen, even as my heart beat with sheer excitement. As for my anxiety about being in the town, it melted clear away. And then, at that point in my wanderings, when I thought I'd seen all there was to see, I came upon the town's great square. Here, in a vast open space, greater than Stromford's entire commons, buildings pressed in on all sides. Some seemed new, some old, some were straight, while others sagged. But the square was dominated by two buildings which stood at opposite sides. By far the biggest structure was a great church, a cathedral, as I would learn, which soared upward with a multitude of towers. These towers, joined together by what looked like floating arches, were emblazoned with countless embellishments and statues that seemed as real as life. Set between the high front towers was a vast circle of stone and multicoloured glass. Below it was the main entry, deep framed with columns and more statues. The whole gigantic structure seemed to rise toward heaven itself, stone leaping into glory. Opposite the church, on the other side of the square, was a large stone building some three stories tall. Whereas the church rose high, this building seemed to cling to the earth with a weight and bulk that bespoke earthly power. On its first level were big wooden doors over which had been set an open space, caged in with metal bars. To either side of these doors were small windows, similarly enclosed. But on the second level, at a considerable height, were four huge windows side by side with pillars and stone tracery. Set before the windows was a balcony under which stone lions' heads protruded. Flags with various designs of blue and gold hung on poles. Other flags were black. Here, too, soldiers paced. The third level had smaller windows, but unlike the church, which stood alone, this building was hemmed in close on either side by ordinary structures. Between the church and this large building was the great open space, the town square itself. It held crowds of traders with booths and stalls, with more sellers of goods and food than I could count. Swarms of buyers were in attendance. Most were walking, but a few were on horseback, wending their way through the middle of the crowds. I walked about the square, gazing at the endless numbers of things being sold, many of them objects I'd never beheld before. Cloth of many colours and types, Muscovy furs, Toledo daggers, Flemish hats, Italian gloves. There were baskets, boxes and boots. There were shoes, tools and armour. As for food and spices, why, I actually saw a bowl full of peppercorns. And everywhere coins clinked and abacuses rattled. I wished I had not already spent my penny. Timidly, I approached the great church itself. For a while I stood before it, trying to decide if I might be allowed to enter. What, I wondered, might it be like to pray in such a place? But aside from its great size, it was the soldiers about the doors that made me hold back. Yet they seemed to be paying very little attention to the crowds of people who went in and out. When I saw children enter, I made the sign of the cross over my heart and went forward. In truth, the soldiers barely looked at me as I passed through an entryway crowned by statues of Mary and Jesus, plus other saints whose names I did not know.
I promised myself I'd return with Bear, who would, I was certain, know them all. But when I stepped past the vestibule, I gasped. Before me was a space of such immense size, height, depth and breadth, that I never would have thought it could exist on mortal earth. Burning candles blossomed everywhere, enough to awe the stars. Through sweet and smoky air, great columns rose to dizzying heights, while enough multicoloured light poured down through stained glass so as to turn the hard stone floor into pools of liquid hues. From somewhere unseen, a chorus of swelling chant rolled forth, filling this celestial space with sounds that made me think of the measured beating of angels' wings. It was as if I'd entered paradise itself. Any number of people were milling about, or were on their knees in prayer. Afraid to go any farther, I sank to my knees too, pressed my hands together, and simply stared with wonder at the church itself, and then at the people. As I knelt, my gaze fastened on a particularly devout man who was kneeling, hands tightly clasped in prayer. Though he was wearing a soldier's quilted canvas jacket, red leggings and high leather boots, somehow he seemed familiar. After a while, he began to look about. As he turned, the hairs at the back of my neck began to prickle. In truth, I could hardly believe what I was seeing. It was none other than John Aycliffe, the steward of Stromford Village. Moreover, I now realized he was not alone, but attended by men dressed in the same livery as those the great lady I had seen had about her person. Even as I began to grasp who it was, Aycliffe shifted farther about. Before I could gather my wits, he turned full face toward me. Our eyes seemed to fasten on one another. It was as if neither of us could believe the other was there, and we were in Stromford's forest once again. But then he set up a cry, shouting, "There!" and pointed right at me. "The boy! The wolf's head! He's here! Catch him!" These men, taken by surprise, spun around, saw whom he meant, then began running in my direction, shouting, knocking down anyone who stood in their way. By then I'd collected wits enough to leap to my feet and race out of the church. Once outside, I plunged into the mass of people in the square, pushing and dodging to get away. After leaving the square, I raced on without any knowledge of where I was, running through one narrow lane after another. I went in no particular direction and never paused to look back. All I could think was that I had to get back to Bear. How long I ran, I don't know. But I was still pelting through a particularly narrow lane when a man leapt out in front of me. "Halt!" he cried, his arms spread wide enough to prevent me from passing. Chapter 39. Gulping for breath, I halted and spun about, only to find that another man had come up behind me. I flung myself against a wall, even as I struggled to get Bear's dagger out of my pocket. With the two men keeping to either side of me, I was unable to confront them both. But one, I saw, had a large stick in his hand. The other held a knife. "Keep away!" I screamed, finally managing to pull Bear's dagger free from its sheath. Though my heart was pounding and my legs were shaking, I held it before me as Bear had taught me. The dagger caused my attackers to hesitate. In that moment, I made a clumsy lunge at the man with the stick. Not only did he nimbly leap out of the way, he brought his stick down hard on my wrist. The pain and shock were so great, I dropped the dagger. The next moment, arms locked around me from behind. I kicked and butted my head back. There was a sharp grunt, and the man's arms went slack, just enough to allow me to break his grasp. head down, I charged straight at the man with the stick, catching him in the chest. He fell back. It was enough. With a burst, I ran past him down the alley. Then I plunged along a different, narrow way, taking one turn after another, not daring even to glance back to see if I were being followed. I don't know how long I ran before I stopped and looked behind. Seeing no one, I allowed myself a moment's rest. Heart thudding to the point of pain, my wrist still smarting where it had been struck, I tried to grasp what had happened. Why Stromford's steward was in Great Wexley was something I could make no sense of. But what was clear was that, far from escaping the pursuers who wished me dead, I'd come to a place where they could trap me. In my frantic state, I was quite sure that not even Bear could protect me. What's more, I had disobeyed him. It was not a thing I was sure he would forgive. And hadn't he told me to run away if attacked? I made up my mind to leave the town. I would get beyond the walls and flee. Exactly where I'd go didn't matter, as long as I escaped. While it was easy to make the decision, I quickly realized I had no idea where I was or where to go in order to leave. With my distress growing every moment, I looked around, trying to get some sense of my whereabouts. When I'd first arrived in Great Wexley, I'd been overwhelmed by the multitude of different things I saw. Now, in a complete turnabout, my panic made everything seem the same. What's more, I couldn't help but feel that lurking behind each corner, each bend of each alley, would be more of my enemies. Still, I also knew I couldn't remain where I was. My pursuers had already proved they knew the town well enough to track me down. Moving with great caution, I wandered down one alley after another, spying ahead, even as I constantly checked behind. What made things worse was that no matter where I went, I had the sensation I'd been there before. It was as if I could make no progress. But then I came to what seemed a good idea. Bear had told me that the great walls encircled the entire town. If that was the case, and I didn't doubt him, I supposed that I could find some part of them as long as I walked a straight line in any one direction. Then, once I found the walls, I'd follow around until I came to the gate through which we had entered. From there, I'd make my exit from the town and flee to safety. Feeling somewhat less apprehensive now that I had a plan, I immediately set off. Though I hurried, I remained alert lest I blunder into another attack. Again and again, I made myself slow down. Try as I did to follow a straight line, I soon discovered it was impossible. The alleys and streets meandered in ways that bewildered me. It was as if I were in a maze. Even so, I forced myself to go on, because I was afraid to stay in any one place. So I made my way by hugging walls, slipping round corners, all but crawling. Daylight was fading. The long summer twilight had begun to ebb. With it came a resumption of a chilly rain. Soon misty dimness cloaked the air. The brightest light came from within houses, or the occasional passer-by, who made his way holding a flaming rush or lantern before him. Fewer and fewer people were abroad. Shadows lengthened. Now and again men would stagger by, clearly having had too much to drink. The only other noise, and it came from shuttered houses, was an occasional burst of laughter, an angry shout. A child called. At last I made out the town walls. They rose high over my head and seemed to melt into the murky sky.
nor were they smooth walls, as I had imagined, but had houses built close against them. Even so, as far as I was concerned, I was making progress. Now, according to my plan, I needed only to follow the wall around. If I did, surely I would come upon the gate through which Bear and I had entered the town. Once again, my plan was faulty. The wall had not been built in a simple circle, but was in fact serpentine. Still, I continued on until I stumbled on a wide street paved with stone. When I recognized it as the one on which Bear and I entered the town, I started to run along it. Then two things happened almost simultaneously. The town's church bells began to ring, and I saw what appeared to be a gate in the wall. Some 9 or 10 soldiers were milling about it. A few carried flares. Though I wasn't sure if it was the same gate by which Bear and I had entered, I told myself it didn't matter. It was a way out of town. I ran toward it. Even as I did, the great doors, hauled by soldiers, swung in and shut. Not believing what I was seeing, I stopped aghast and watched as the soldiers dropped huge beams across the doors to brace them shut. Then they added chains and even locks to keep the doors securely closed. Having shut the gates, most of the soldiers began to stroll away, leaving only two behind. I drew close enough for them to notice me.
"Did you want to leave?" one of them called.
"Yes, sir," I said.
"Too late. They closed. They'll be open in the morning at prime. Now, get yourself away. The curfew has begun. You should be behind doors."
I remained standing where I was, unsure what to do.
"Be off with you," a soldier shouted.
I turned and began to wander away. It had become night. The rain intensified. The streets, now swamps of muck and mud, were all but deserted save for a few laggards. Even they moved hurriedly, no doubt wanting to get behind doors lest they be taken up and charged. Animals began to emerge, mostly pigs and dogs, but rats too. They were splashing about in search of things to eat. As night thickened, people put up their house shutters. The town grew even darker than before. Hearing the sound of marching, I turned quickly. Some 6 helmeted soldiers, armed with broadswords and bearing lanterns, were coming down the street. I leapt into a narrow alley and peered out. As they went by, one of the soldiers shouted out,
"The hour of Compline is at hand. The curfew is in force. No one may be on the streets."
As they passed, I shrank back, listening as the tramp and shouts grew fainter. It was night now. The town seemed asleep. The sky was black. The rain still fell. I wandered on, wet and miserable, looking for a place to conceal myself, hoping I might stumble upon the green man. The only sound I heard was the squish of my feet on the mud or stones. I hardly dared to breathe. Then I heard the sound of running feet. I pressed myself against the wall and peeked out around a corner. A group of men, torches held aloft, hurried past. By the light of their torches, I glimpsed their blue and gold livery. It was the same livery as Lady Furnival's entourage wore. But I recognised them as the steward's men. How could that be? Then I recalled something that I had heard the stranger say in the forest. Aycliffe was Lady Furnival's kin. I wanted to think things through, but feared to take the time. Instead, I backed away and scurried down the narrowest of alleys, the walls so close I could have touched either side by stretching out both arms. I was halfway down it when I saw the hulking form of someone lurching toward me,
hooded lantern in hand. I stopped, turned, and began to run in the opposite direction, only to hear a thunderous, "Crispin! Stop!" Chapter 40. Hearing my name called so terrified me, I stopped and turned around. The man had drawn closer, but as I couldn't see his face, I shrank away. Only when the voice called out again, even angrier, "Crispin, you stunted son of a scoundrel!" did I realize it was Bear. Heart exploding with relief, I ran toward him and flung myself at his knees, embracing him with fervor. "Where, by the sins of Lucifer, have you been?" the huge man said, setting his lantern on the ground. Prying me loose, then putting his great hands on both my shoulders, he made me stand before him. At the same time, he went to his knees so I could look into his eyes. "Bear," I said, unable to say more, because I'd put my arms around him and pressed into his neck and beard, like an infant sparrow returned to his nest.
"Crispin," he scolded, "I waited all afternoon for you to return. Did you forget me so soon? Is this the way you repay my kindness? I should give you a sound whipping."
"I didn't mean to. I lost my way, and I was attacked."
"Attacked?"
he said, prying me loose from his neck so he could look into my face.
"By whom?"
"The steward's men."
"What steward?"
"From Stromford, John Aycliffe. He's come after me," I went on in a rush. "I saw him in the great church, but he saw me too. The moment he did, he set men upon me, and Bear, I remembered something else. He's Lady Furnival's kin. I even saw her. You said Great Wexley was Furnival's principal home, that Stromford was one of his holdings. Now that Lord Furnival is dead, Lady Furnival must have summoned Aycliffe."
"I feared that might happen."
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"I wanted to avoid it all."
"My wrist is numb where they struck me."
"Then you'll have to walk on your feet," he said, grinning.
With that, he turned about and began to wend his way through back streets and dark alleys, his lantern barely showing the way through the dark and rain. "When I tried to defend myself," I said after we had gone for a while, "I lost your dagger."
"I'm sure you used it well."
"Bear," I said as we went along.
"What?"
"God bless you."
"And you also,"
he returned gruffly. Only when I was secure behind the doors of Widow Daventry's inn did I draw a fully relaxed breath. I looked about. The main room was deserted. "Bear, you need to tell me what I should do if..." The widow came into the room. As she did, Bear put up his hand to silence me. "Oh," the woman said, "you found him."
"He was wandering and became lost," Bear said, not mentioning the attack.
"Did the watch see you?"
she asked me.
"I don't think so." "Good," she drew herself up. "I'm afraid John Ball has just arrived."
"Where is he?"
Bear said.
"In the kitchen. He demanded to be fed."
"Fine. I'll get the boy to the room. Can you fetch him something to eat? And some dry clothes?"
"I'll get some,"
the woman said, and left the room. Giving me no explanation as to what his exchange with Widow Daventry had been about, Bear and I returned to our room. Once there, he set the lantern on the table, then bade me lie down on the pallet. When I did, Bear sat down by my side, but instead of speaking, became lost in his thoughts. Even so, I felt comforted. Widow Daventry opened the door and stuck her head inside.
"He's getting anxious," she said.
"He always was the impatient man," Bear muttered. "I'm coming."
The woman left. Bear stood and stepped toward the door.
Now, eat your bread and go to sleep."
"Will you truly forgive me?" I said.
"There's nothing to forgive. Sometimes I forget."
"Forget what?"
"How little you know."
With no further words, he went away. Left alone, I hardly knew what to think. But after what had just happened to me, and how he'd come after me, I had no heart to question him. Chapter 41. I sat on the straw and ate the bread. Afterward, wanting to give thanks for my safe return, I took Goodwife Peregrine's pouch from around my neck and removed my mother's cross of lead. With it in my hands, I began to say my prayers in a low voice. As usual, I prayed for the well-being of my mother's and my father's souls. This time, I added Bear's name to those for whom I begged protection. Prayers done, I lay back on the pallet and thought of all I had seen and done that day. It was hard to grasp. Then I listened to the rain as it continued to beat down, hoping it would lull me to sleep. My mind kept returning to this man, this John Ball, whom Bear was meeting, wondering if he were part of my puzzle, and why Bear was hiding him from me. Unable to resist, I got up and crept out the door, then out to the dim hall. When I reached the steps, I moved down silently, holding on to the wall for balance. Halfway, I paused and looked into the dimly lit room. Bear was sitting at a table, his back to me. Standing by his side was Widow Daventry. Seated opposite was a man who I assumed was John Ball. Compared to Bear, the man was quite small, though his face, what I could make out of it, was strong, with a large nose, deep-set eyes, and a severe mouth. His brown robes and tonsured hair showed him to be a priest. That in itself surprised me, because Bear had told me he had little faith in priests.
"And the city apprentices," I heard Bear say. "What of them?"
"Of like minds," said John Ball. "As angry as any other. The constant wars in France, the taxes and harsh fees, these things grind them down as well as any man, peasant or not. They want, need, better wages and an end to the guilds."
"All that may be true," Bear said. "But from what I've seen and heard in my travels, they won't rise up now."
"They will if they can reclaim their ancient freedoms," said Ball. "And with the righteous hand of God," he lifted a fist, "it is my destiny to lead them."
"Then you had better to wait till King Edward dies," Bear said.
"How long will that be?"
"Soon."
"Can you be certain?"
"It's all the talk of London," Bear said, "as well as the court at Westminster."
"And who will succeed to the throne?" said John Ball.
"It could be his son, the Duke of Lancaster."
"The most hated man in England?
That would help us." "But the true heir," Bear went on, "is the king's grandson, Richard of Bordeaux."
"The child," said John Ball, "better yet, that would bring even greater weakness."
"Why do you think this is the proper time for an uprising in these parts?" I heard Bear ask.
"Lord Furnival is dead," said John Ball.
"There is already much confusion.
Lady Furnival has summoned all the authorities from his manors. With no known heirs, she is vulnerable."
"Now listen to me, John Ball," Bear said. "It's not for me to tell you how to act. But if we are to talk of Furnival's heirs, in my travels I've discovered something of great importance."
He spoke so low that his words became indistinct. But I'd heard enough. I drew back up the stairs. That Bear was engaged in rebellion of some sort, I could not doubt. In Stromford, mere talk of such things was considered a hanging offence. What would happen if Bear were caught? It seemed, moreover, that he was not just a juggler, but some kind of spy. As I lay on the pallet, I tossed and turned until I finally decided it was air I needed. Getting up, I poked the shuttered windows open a little way, then glanced down upon the street. At first I thought it was deserted. Then, across the street, I saw a figure standing in the shadow of an overhanging building. I thought of going down the steps and telling Bear. Instead, I held back. This time, I would stay put, as I'd been told. As I lay back on the hay, I was determined to remain awake until Bear returned, so I could tell him what I'd seen. But the day had been long and tumultuous. Despite my intentions, I fell asleep. Chapter 42. I woke the next morning to the deafening peal of bells. They were so loud, so tumultuous. For a brief moment, I thought the day of judgment had arrived. Then I remembered I was in the town of Great Wexley with its many churches, and it was the feast of John the Baptist. Even so, it was strange to waken in so closed a space, the air stale, the only light being that which slipped through the cracks in the shuttered window. But the pain in my wrist had gone, with only a blue mark to remind me of the attack. I turned to Bear, wanting to tell him about the man I'd seen outside the tavern the night before, but he, taking up most of the space on the pallet, remained asleep. To amuse myself, I plucked fleas from the straw and crushed them between my fingers. When Bear still didn't wake, I grew restless and crept out of the room, making my way down the steps to the inn's main floor. Halfway down, I stopped. The smell of wine was ripe and blended into the more embracing warmth of new-baked bread.